Hello and welcome. My guest today is Brian Johnson. Brian sold Braintree Venmo to PayPal for $800 million in 2013, and it turns out that was just the start of his journey. He's also went viral in the past week for spending $2 million on his body every year, but this conversation wasn't that. It was instead about artificial intelligence, creating alignment within self, zero principle thinking, the big change in Brian's life, why Brian is kind to his detractors, parenting, and much more. I would like to note that I included the pauses in Brian's speech because I feel as if they denote his thoughtfulness and how he considers answers. It's incredibly rare to ask someone a question and multiple times for them to pause for 5-10 seconds. So I hope that doesn't detract from your listening experience. And I really think that it adds to Brian's thoughtfulness. And I am looking forward to hearing your thoughts about this episode. If you enjoy it, please share it. About 10 hours of prep and about 5 hours of post-production went into making this podcast a reality. So if it resonates, send it to someone you think will enjoy it as well. Tweets, texts, Instagram stories, throw it in your group chat. They all go a long way. And the show only grows if you share it. And if the show grows, we can get better guests. And if we get better guests, the show will grow. A beautiful, never-ending cycle. So I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. And here's a little preview of what to expect.
I've never been happier in my entire life. I've never been more at peace. I've never been in a better state. And it gets counterintuitive. You know, like I took the thing that all of us consider to be the most precious thing in existence, and I took away its authority.
Brian Johnson, welcome to the podcast. Very honored and grateful for you to be here, and I'd like to start this off by a nice little introduction so people can have some context for exactly who you are. Brian Johnson is the world's most measured human. Johnson sold his company Braintree Venmo to PayPal for $800 million in 2013. Since then, he's been investing millions to reduce aging. In 2021, he reduced his epigenetic age by 5.1 years in 7 months, which is a world record. His open source protocol Project Blueprint is an endeavor to achieve humanity and Earth scale cooperation starting within self. He's also the founder and CEO of Kernel, creator of the world's first mainstream non-invasive neuroimaging system, and OS Fund, where he's invested $100 million into the predictable engineering of atoms, molecules, and organisms into companies now collectively valued over $6 billion. He is an outdoor adventure enthusiast, pilot, and author of children's books, Code 7, and The Proto Project. Brian, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I would love to start with the final piece of that bio, which is the children's books. Why did you decide to write children's books?
My kids and I had a ritual every night where we'd bathe. I'd bathe them. We'd go into their bedrooms and all three of them would sleep in the same room. We had this small little house and I would make up stories on the spot. And I would ask them a few questions prior to starting the storytelling about what they did in the day and interactions with friends, teachers, homework assignments, things that happened at recess. And they would randomly comment on, you know, this or that. And then I would take those nuggets and I would incorporate them into stories and I'd make them the protagonists. And you know, at the time, I think my oldest was maybe 8 or 9 when this ritual, six or seven when the ritual started. And they would get lost in the stories. Their faces would contort and change. I could just see them living it as though it were real. And it became such a fun ritual every night that we did this that I thought, you know what, why don't I just take a few of these things and write them up in a book? And I honestly didn't expect anyone to ever read it. And I thought this would just be fun to go through the process of writing a book. And surprisingly, the book has sold, I think, over 250,000 copies now.
Oh, my God.
It's been really surprising. And to get the notes from kids who have read it in school, even now, 5-6 years later, it's fun.
What is the basis of the books?
Code 7 is an anthology, so it's a story. Each chapter is a story of a certain character, and they're working on a certain thing in life, a certain attribute, perseverance or courage or honesty. And then in the seventh chapter, they all come together to do something meaningful. And in the Proto Project, it's about humans and AI interacting and how the two co-evolve to solve problems.
When we speak about humans and AI coming together to solve problems, they're the narrative and the focus for Hollywood and mainstream culture is that is a doomsday scenario. Technology is here to eat us, and it's going to be a negative consequence. My question to you is, like, why do you think that is the case? Why do we think the worst about technology, and why has that been programmed into us when it also could be the complete opposite? And some may argue that it has been the complete opposite in the last 100 or 1,000 years.
Reflecting back on as what I've learned in life, I would say that it's a roundabout way to get to your question. When I was in my early 20s, I started reading a lot of behavioral economics and specifically learning how flawed my mind is. I learned that I had over 188 cognitive biases, so distortions of reality that my brain actively makes on a daily basis, and I'm oblivious to it. I wasn't aware. Prior to reading this literature, I had this default assumption that I was rational and consistent, and I could see other people's flaws, that I was the one that was coherently understanding the world. And when I started poking into this material and I realized how flawed my cognition was, and even my internal dialogues, it fundamentally changed how I understand myself and the world. And so every thought that landed into my brain, I didn't treat it as right. I treated it as, oh, interesting. Let's see what you've delivered up and how many biases are attached to this thing. And then I also started at the time learning a lot about systems and how we are born into systems that we are oblivious to. So like, for example, I was born into a religion in a small town, and the entire apparatus of my existence were the rules and social systems of this thing. And unless you actually take time to pull back the layers of the onion, you don't really know. And so when you pose the question of, you know, why would media take a topic like artificial intelligence and create these narratives, and why would people respond that way, and then why are these things forming? To me, the most beneficial thing to do is to understand it as what's happening in individual minds, what's happening in collective minds, which systems are producing it, and why it's interesting. And so, in short, instead of listening to what they're saying, to dissect the systems that are creating those things, to see behind the curtain. Oftentimes, it's not interesting to hear what someone has to say. It's interesting to understand why they say it.
So, by that same token, why is media saying that technology is bad?
I mean, there's a lot of... I'd say, okay, we're going to start trying to peel this thing back. Their motivations are for views and clicks. And fear is one of the very best ways to go about doing that. Artificial intelligence is new and foreign. And everything new and foreign triggers a response in our brains that we're scared of it. So that's just a natural human response. So it's the knee-jerk reaction of fear. It's narratives that are popularized. It really energizes people to debate these things. So it not only a fear response, but people jump in on both sides and take hard edges. So it feeds the systems of human reaction that we have in society. And it's like this phenomena that we see in social media today. You drop a controversial topic, the world splits in two, and the arguments that form on both sides form pretty quickly, then are cemented, and then it just is just back and forth. And it's almost of such a predictable nature and unproductive in so many ways that this tribalism is the thing that just fuels us. And so maybe it's something we should really be thinking about is these default systems. I mean, this is kind of some of the thinking behind Blueprint is we have been the same Homo sapien for hundreds of years, thousands of years. Not much has changed. Our technology has changed, but we, in our basic construction, have not. And I think that's about to change, and radically so. And if we were to reimagine what it would be like to be human, the discussions we have about things that are foreign, like new technologies, might take on a very different form. But you know, I guess in the end, I do wonder, my imagination goes to, what if we really considered ourselves to be on the same team, all of us? What would that look like? You know, like how much of our energy is spent in fighting each other and in violence and jealousy and other things? Not to say those things don't have attributes in terms of people competing. They certainly do. But I don't know, it's an imagination exercise. I enjoy experiencing because I don't think it's unimaginable if that could be a possibility.
Do you believe then we would need some sort of common enemy that was outside of us? I can imagine a world in which aliens come about and or there's some external force that's threatening us. You saw this in COVID in some respect where there was an external enemy that humans could then surround themselves with and promote positivity within each other too. And that was a beautiful thing to witness.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're identifying that given the current configuration of Homo sapiens, it takes an exogenous shock like aliens or COVID or something, aliens in movie or COVID in reality, to unite what was previously a group of tribal behavior. And so I think that's true today, but if you change the basis of that and you say, okay, you're no longer dealing with the same human configurations, that's changed, maybe exogenous shocks are no longer needed. And I suppose that's a question I'm interested in is, I'm not sure it's a reliable assumption to say that we can imagine us being the same as we are now in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Some of the fundamentals about being human may change in a meaningful enough way that these exogenous shocks are no longer needed to be the thing that breaks down tribalism.
How, in your view, is the human going to change so radically?
With my Project Blueprint, the primary observation was that when my mind was able to do what it wanted and when it wanted, it continuously continuously engaged in self-destructive behavior. I would overeat. You know, I would do things excessively. And it's funny because, you know, we humans say we are the most intelligent species on this planet, yet we commit a tremendous amount of self-sabotage on a routine basis. And over our entire lifetime, we may make the same mistake thousands of times, and we are helpless to stop repeating that mistake. And so, I don't know, is it kind of embarrassing? Maybe. And so I was making this observation that my mind, I'll just blame it on my mind. My mind was the thing doing this. And my solution was, what if instead I was able to stop my problem of overeating, to address, you know, I would try to drown my stresses of life by binging on food. What if instead of doing that, what if I could measure all the organs in my body, empower each organ to speak for itself? So my heart could have a vote about what I eat and when I eat, and the same with my other 70 plus organs. And in doing that, I gave my organs the power of decision making. And I, at the same time, I demotored my conscious mind. So that meant I could no longer look at a menu and decide what I was going to order. I no longer could decide in a spontaneous moment to have a pizza party. I could no longer do these things. I could no longer have a second helping if I wanted it. My mind was removed from the equation entirely. And that's resulted in me achieving the very best health results of my life. As you mentioned, I achieved a world record in reducing my epigenetic age. I've slowed my rate of aging by 24%. I have 50 perfect biomarkers, 100 biomarkers that are less than my chronological age. My body runs 3 degrees cooler than average. And all these things happened because I empowered my organs to express what they wanted instead of my mind tyrannically overpowering the well-being of everything else about me to get its purpose. And so to me, it's really the first step in trying and imagining becoming a better human for me was putting my mind in check because it was running wild and it was ruining so much of what I cared about in life.
Yeah, you've said before, everything is a byproduct of the mind. And what's interesting is your experiments are showing that the body, impacting the body, can change the mind, which means if everything's a byproduct of the mind, maybe everything is a byproduct of the body, which impacts the mind as well. What's your take on that?
That's well said. If you say, okay, for the past couple billion years, evolution has been the primary information processing system on planet Earth that has been increasing the organization of intelligence. So evolution has been the primary mode. Homo sapiens are now the dominant architects of information, and we're now giving rise to machines, or software, as being a architect of intelligence. And so over time, the systems of intelligence have become increasingly more sophisticated, each giving rise to the other. And thinking about everything as a byproduct of the mind, if we are giving rise to this new form of intelligence in the form of AI, it's worthwhile for us to poke at and say, what are the characteristics of this intelligence? Where does it really excel? Where might it have problems? How might we improve it? And this goes back to my personal realization in my early 20s where, oh, wow, I'm a really flawed system of intelligence. Like, I have 188 flaws I can identify right now of errors my system of intelligence is making in order to navigate a complicated world. And then you layer on other things like emotional whiplashing from this and that. And so me as an architect of intelligence, I need to really think carefully about myself and the decisions I make. And then we need to think about ourselves as a system of humans. So I guess in short, I would say that a possibility is we currently hold our conscious minds and our freedom of choice to be probably the most sacred characteristic of our existence, our right to choose. And in order for me to stop my destructive path, I willfully chose to demote that authority and elevate another authority that was within self, my organs. And so oftentimes when I talk about this, this is an extremely difficult thought for people to get around, because if they think about it thoroughly, they sometimes they'll say, if I don't have freedom of choice, I don't know how I am going to exist. Like, they just can't imagine an existence without it. But for me, it's been the most liberating outcome of my life.
You've said before that your it is difficult. It has been a brutal environment in your brain. I don't know when exactly you felt that way. I'm curious, do you still feel that way after all these biomarkers are perfect, after reducing your age, after becoming the best body that you possibly can and giving your organs a vote? Do you still feel as if it's a brutal environment in your brain?
Nowhere near where it was when I was depressed and overeating and kind of in just chaos and mayhem. It was a 10 out of 10 brutal. I mean, if it would be actually interesting if there was a transcript of all the thoughts and emotions that were happening, running, and, you know, we could see each other's real-time transcript. Maybe we'd be a lot nicer to each other. I mean, like, you know, like, wow, you're in some serious pain just like me. And, you know, you are smiling, and from the outside, it looks like you're doing really well in life, but man, yeah, your pain looks like it's about like mine. But also, now that I've implemented the system, I'm in a better state mentally than I ever have been in my entire life. You know, those voices are so quiet and they don't have the sharp edges. And that's again why I appreciate this so much, is I think a lot of people, when they see what I'm doing at Blueprint, a common reaction is people assume that I'm not happy or can't be happy or impossibly not, you know, it's almost like they want me to be sad because they want to see, they don't want to see that it might be a good idea for them to change themselves. And it's going to be much easier if they can just say he's miserable, and it relieves them of any kind of feeling of having to do anything. But, you know, I've never been happier in my entire life. I've never been more at peace. I've never been in a better state. And it gets counterintuitive. You know, like, I took the thing that all of us consider to be the most precious thing in existence, and I took away its authority.
It's beautiful. So what exactly have you done to create this change? And what exactly can a person listening do to start to take the steps to feel happier in their mind because of working with their body?
Maybe I'll explain the why I'm doing this, and then it may make more sense for the person. If you zoom out on planet Earth and you try to assess what is really going on planet Earth, like, you know, really, really, like, let's take away all the noise and all the stuff that doesn't matter, what is really going on? And we can probably make a few observations. We can say, well, one, the climate's changing, and it may be a much bigger deal than we've modeled out, even worst case predictions. We probably should pay attention to this. We're giving rise to a new form of intelligence that has the ability to improve at speeds that are almost incomprehensible to us. And then we have a bunch of other things going on, which are probably much more minor, but that's probably only two things: the environment to make the Earth sustainable, and the rise of this new intelligence. And I guess, like, third, you've got this omnipresent threat of the intelligences that now occupy Earth destroying each other. You know, like, how do you stop the annihilation or, you know, some catastrophic event from happening? And so if you say, okay, now we've narrowed the scope of things we're going to consider, then what might we do to build the best possible future? And I would say, like, how do we build a game where we just keep on playing the game? New experiences, new ways of being, the expansion of you know, intelligent existence. Then I really start within self, and I say, okay, the very first thing I want to solve for is, can I solve the goal alignment problem within me? So within Brian, I've got all these warring factions. My mind's like, I want to eat the brownie, and my heart's like, please don't. You know, Weekend Brian wants to down a bunch of liquor to take it easy, and Kidney Brian is like, and Living Brian is like, no, please don't. So you have all these conflicting things within the body, and so you really need to get goal alignment within self. And that's what I did with this program, is I got everyone to cooperate. Because typically when we look at the all the problems in the world, we point out at everyone else, like what they're doing incorrectly, and how we want to fix it. Rarely do we point at self. And so fixing it within self, but really this model is the same thing as we would tackle with the earth. We'd say, okay, earth is our body. We would make millions of measurements around the earth, just like I do with my body. And we would find the optimal configuration with science, and then we'd make those conditions be true. But right now, we humans are treating the earth like we treat our bodies. We do whatever we want, whenever we want, without regard. And then we kind of look around like, it's not my problem. Like, I'm just doing my thing.
And so you've explained the why, and I'm curious, like, what the person should do is, how do they go about creating more alignment within self?
These problems are, sustainability on Earth and the emergence of AI, they're big problems that very few people can do meaningful things about. Right? You can recycle your Amazon boxes, and they're very hard things to do. And so that's why starting with self is the baby step that everybody can take, where it's a little bit of control of identifying that everybody has a role to play in this, and that even though it seems non-intuitive that you would fix something within yourself to address an outside problem, that's the baby step. And so to me, it's adopting a new way of being to acknowledge that letting our minds do whatever they want, whenever they want, is not good for ourselves, it's not good for the planet, and it's not good for our future. And that a new way of being, for example, of empowering all the organs of your body and trying to achieve goal alignment within self, is a new way of being. And so if you map this out, like, here's where I think we're going. If you map this out in the near future, I think what the world looks like is a giant computational model of goal alignment with trillions of computations happening every second within self, between each other, with the planet, and with AI. Trillions of agents of intelligence, and it's one big tapestry of intelligence goal aligning all the time. So in the same way that my body is doing this right now as we speak, like, there's breakages in my biology, there's repair happening, there's antioxidants, and there's inflammation, and there's all these different things happening, and my body's trying to steady itself. It's doing its own goal alignment algorithm, and I'm trying to help it so it can align itself to its optimal state. And you and I in this conversation are doing this dance of trying to goal align on, we're talking about certain ideas. And the same thing applies with our machines and with Earth. And so it's this new way of understanding ourselves, that it's not our mind's every whim which we should be paying attention to. And these are the things that are causing so many of the problems in the world, all of our heated debates and the acrimony and the tribalism. It's allowing our knee-jerk reactions to rule everything. It's how we opened up this conversation. You drop a topic in, everybody breaks out into their tribes, they put their war paint on, and they start hammering away at each other. And it's just like, no one's winning in that situation. Everyone's, dug in. So it's a new belief system on how we build ourselves, how we are immersed within the tapestry of everything else, all intelligent agents. And so again, it's a little bit of an indirect answer, and these are big ideas that are hard to understand. But I think that's the kind of jump that is relevant for us to consider as what is the future of being human? Because right now it's a little, I'm not sure our current approach at trying to tackle these problems is equal to what we need to bring to the table in order to solve them in a wise way.
One thing I'm curious to get your perspective on is what makes for a better human, right? We know what it looks like to improve our biomarkers, mm-hmm. and a human who could do, let's say, 20 pull-ups is better than a human that could do 10 pull-ups. But it can seem like it gets more difficult when it's the areas of the mind or when it's characteristics and traits. And I'm sure you doing work and thinking about children's books actually helped you figure out, like, what actually is an ideal human look like? Mm-hmm.
In answering that question, my mind immediately begins to map all of today's social and ethical and moral norms. And it's inescapable that you and I pose this question and we're going to start hitting up against those walls of expectations of, because we have those standards in society today. And if we carefully walked through that list, I think we could say, well, humans generally value the idea of, you know, reciprocity, where if one person does something for one person, the person feels obliged or appropriate, and then that creates social fabric. And we could delineate this in a, you know, like a detached observational exercise. I would rather take your question and say, okay, we can depict what happened, what it goes on today. What may be also interesting in a conversation is what might we evolve into that we can't imagine? Because we know that whatever we all experience in this moment is simply a snapshot of time, because 100 years ago, it was very different, and 200 years ago, it was very different, and in 2 weeks, it's going to be different. So we're only talking about this very narrow moment of time, and we're reflecting on what we can observe in the world. But this goes back, it goes to building a system and letting it evolve by itself without knowing where it's gonna go. So again, this is the case with myself, is I measure all my organs. I perform hundreds of measurements on my body, including blood and saliva, urine, stool. I do imaging, MRI, ultrasound, I do fitness tests. I mean, I do hundreds of measurements on my body to look at everything happening. Then that data is taken and it's compared against or looked at with gold standard scientific evidence. And with that gold standard scientific evidence, protocols are then developed, you know, eat this, do this at this time with this protocol. And then it's repeat again, measurement, science, protocol, continually. And in that case, we don't set norms on where we're going to end up. We just let the body roll through its natural processes. And so when we say what is the ideal human, we could answer, or what is a good person, we could answer that question today. But I think what's interesting is if we say, okay, we really are at this point where we can walk through an exercise and say, what is an ideal human in 2050? First, we have no idea. We don't know what the morals are going to be, the ethics, the social norms, no clue. And we don't have any reason to believe we can have any starting assumptions at this point.
Wait, I just want to push back on that point, because we can look at 1700 and we can look at 1400 and we could say, what were the ideal mm-hmm. traits of that time? And so based on the past, we could extrapolate to the future from that perspective.
What makes you believe we could do that?
Well, we could look in alignment and see, okay, how many of these attributes in 1800 that Benjamin Franklin esteemed or said were valuable to him are also valuable today? Why wouldn't that same test still apply in 2050?
What conditions have changed from today?
All of them.
And what conditions will be different in 2050?
We have no idea.
Why do you think we could then therefore map?
Because if you can identify the characteristics or the traits that have existed in the past, we can look at those and ask ourselves, what are the possibilities for this to change so drastically? We don't know for sure what it will be in 2050. We can't predict with perfect clarity, but we can say, all right, well, this attribute has been useful for, I don't know, the past 1,000 years or 10,000. So it would be unexpected for us to have such a drastic change, but obviously anything could happen, and you're envisioning a world in which truly anything could happen.
Yeah, I was a couple of years ago, I was in the Middle East with a leader of a country, and he was telling me about his country's 2030 goals. And this was in the year 2017. And I said, it's remarkable to be in your position having to plan out 13 years in advance. Like, how would you even dare take on such a challenge, because the world's going to change radically in that period of time? And he said, okay, fair. Like, but I have to do something. It's like, how would you think about it? And so I offered him a thought experiment in the moment of just trying to get my own mind around it. And I said, okay, let's imagine we are playing a game and there's a robot here in the sand, and we want to get the robot to the most distant sand dune on the horizon. We could take one of two approaches. One is we could take a topographical map of the sand dunes, and we could load that map into the robot and say, all right, robot, go. So the robot takes off in the sand, and within a few minutes, the robot is stuck in the sand because the sand's shifted. The map changed. The second alternative or option would be to say, all right, robot, you're going to this sand dune over there. We're not going to give you any map. We're just going to give you the GPS coordinates, but we're going to give you these tools so that you can adapt to when the sand changes. If you were to look at those two, I would be more inclined to build a robot that was adaptable to changing sands than I would be to trying to predict the map of the sand. And that's what I'm saying with imagining the future of being human, is our ability to predict is we're in a compromised position. I'd much rather build systems that allow us to adapt to the changing sands of whatever happens, especially with AI now here and evolving very quickly. The primary skill set we have as humans is our adaptability to these circumstances. And that's why I say that I'm in this thought experiment, I'm willing to say I have zero assumptions about the year 2050, other than I have some form of existence. Otherwise, I'm willing to engage in a system of just being entirely adaptable and rolling in that general trajectory. In the same way I manage my health. Like, I basically built the robot in the sand for my body and just said, go. Like, here are the systems, adapt to whatever comes, but I'm going to take out my wild and crazy mind that just ruins the whole thing for everybody.
Yeah. So on that point, you've said before that you want to be living for the person in 2050 or 2500. How do you attempt to do that when you don't even know what the people are going to value at that time?
John Adams made a great observation where he said, I forget the exact quote, but he basically said, you know, he's dedicating his life to giving birth to this new nation so that his children can spend time working on art and poetry and other things. He was astutely observing that a person in their time and place contribute something to scaffold up others. And so we are building scaffolding that will enable those who come after us. And so the question is, what scaffolding are we offering up that helps the next generation? It's one of the reasons why John Adams was so inspiring to me, is people who really understand their time and place, and you know, they know what's out of reach, they know what they can do in their time and place, and they know what it gives birth to, what it gives rise to. And that's why I think it's interesting thinking about evolution giving rise to humans and humans giving rise to artificial intelligence, is we're in this baton passing game. And as humans, I personally have a strong interest in riding this wave of time, of basically keep on playing the game. And you know, there's a James Karas, the author, talks about finite games and infinite games. A finite game is there's a beginning and an end. So it's much of like our sports, how we play football, basketball, baseball. An infinite game is the players of the game only want to keep on playing. And this, again, goes back to our question of, can we imagine all of us, everyone on planet Earth, cooperating towards shared goals, which again is goal alignment. It's the same problem I had with my body. Can I imagine my entire body working in unison for the same goal? And I've never had that, right? I've always had all this conflict. My mind wants to eat bad things. It wants to indulge. It wants to have excess. It does things that hurts my body. It's the same thing we do as a species. We are not goal aligned, and we hurt ourselves by having all this conflict. We're hurting planet Earth. So at the core, it goes back to goal alignment. Can we individually, can we collectively have shared goals in this? It doesn't have to be unison. It doesn't have to be a kumbaya, but can it be a system of you know, conflict resolution and a system of goal alignment that gets us on this trajectory of playing infinite games? And it's a pretty big jump from where we're at today. And it takes a minute to breathe into. This is not a naive call for world peace. It's not a naive thing of, can we all get along? I'm talking about it from an information processing and systems perspective. Can we build the systems? Can we build the robot in the sand that can adapt to all the change we're going to encounter? And can we keep on playing the game together?
What do you have where do you think the ambition to think this big and dream this big originally stems from for you?
I do not trust my mind in answering that question. You know, you gave me a softball answer and my mind's like, tell them how awesome you are. Or you know, like, it's all, I don't know. I don't know why I do what I do and why it's come about. And then, you know, I could probably make up a cute story, but I think it wouldn't be true. You know, like, this is the funny thing about our minds is we are not our minds. And watching them in action is really funny, and watching my own self in action is kind of funny. So, I don't know how to answer the question.
Well, that's fair. Maybe a better question might be, where does your desire to seek truth come from? Because even within this conversation, it is clear you very thoughtful about how you're answering the specific word choices you're using. And it feels to me, at least, that you're aiming and pointing those at truth. And where do you think your desire to seek truth comes from?
I suppose I've had a lot of practice at this, being an entrepreneur. You live and die by the correctness of your decisions. You need to predict the future and make hundreds of decisions very rapidly with very little information. And I think you can boil my philosophy of life down to one sentence. Lucky us, we exist. Let's build an infinite game to play. I'm unaware of asking to exist right now. As far as I know, I just showed up and I'm here. And now that I'm here, I really enjoy it. And I want to keep on existing. And I don't think that it is reasonable whatsoever for me to put any boundaries on the possibilities of my existence. You know, it could be the case that we are like Homo erectus is to us. Homo erectus lived millions of years ago. I like the thought experiment. If you would have asked Homo erectus, give us your best shot of, you know, what's possible in your future evolution, it's doubtful that Homo erectus would have come up with quantum physics. Yep, the emergence of computational intelligence. And I think we may be Homo erectus in relationship to artificial intelligence very soon. And therefore, that's why I don't give my own intelligence or imagination or creativity any weight whatsoever in being able to map the possibility. All I'm saying is the possibility seem greater than I can reach. The game seems like a fun one to play. It would be, I think, an interesting possibility if we could reimagine how we are as a species and cooperate in an interesting way that would be a step forward from our primal behaviors right now of tribalism and destruction and violence and all the wasteful things we do with our massive brains.
So what do you think are the best and the worst case scenarios for our future associated with artificial intelligence?
I think it's an impossible thing to predict. It's an impossible thing to map. Given those conditions, the best thing we can do, in my estimation, is to immerse ourselves in this tapestry of intelligence. And so, again, this is my project blueprint. I built an algorithm that takes care of me better than I can take care of myself. And the algorithm is measurement to science to protocol. I have willfully given the care of me over to an algorithm. And it serves my interests better than I can serve my own interests. And so there's this discussion. Oftentimes we hear about this idea of goal alignment. You know, like the AIs are going to turn us all into paperclips or something like that. Now, that is not discounting that argument, but the idea that goal alignment between humans and machines, we don't even have goal alignment within self, let alone between all of humanity. And to me, it's kind of an absurd proposition that we'd bucket and say AI has one set of interests and alignment and humans have another. To start that proposition, if we're trying to brick by brick build this thing up, I really care to build goal alignment within me first. And the first thing I need to know is I do not represent my own best interests. I do things which self-sabotage. I do things which accelerate my aging and the onset of disease and make myself miserable, feeling, you know, terrible after certain things. Now, I can spin up dozens of stories for you and tell you why that's a beautiful life and that's how I find meaning and how if I can't do those things, then it's not worth existing. But the plain truth is, in a previous form of Brian, he did more self-sabotage in a system that I truly want. And so this is like the kind of reflection I think we need to have is honestly admitting, each of us, that we are incapable of truly acting in our best interests all the time. We do things that we're not. And again, everyone's got a colorful and fancy story on why they do it. It's just cover up.
When did that change happen to you? Of saying, okay, like the Brian that I'm living as is not the Brian that I want to live in as the future. And how do you suggest people come to that realization themselves of, oh, wow, I'm actually living a life that is harmful to me?
It was 10 years ago, maybe like 8 to 10 years ago. I was in a pretty bad spot where I had had chronic depression for a decade. I was in a bad, you know, struggling relationship. I was leaving the religion I was born into. You know, I just sold Braintree. So I had all this newfound wealth and like complications and whatever with it. And I was 60 pounds heavier than I am now. And the stresses of all the, and building Braintree, you know, all the time. So like the stresses of life would come crashing down on me every night at 7 p.m. In the morning, I'd be great. I'd exercise in the morning, do well all day. Then 7 p.m., all the stresses would just be like a ton of bricks. And I would address my overwhelming stress by overeating. I would try to bury my stress with food. And I was absolutely helpless to try to fix it. I mean, I tried everything. I would tell myself all day long, I'm not gonna do it. And that moment came and like, oh, but just tonight, tomorrow you can start. And like, we all know the excuses. And I was helpless to stop myself. And so one night I just playfully said, evening Brian is fired. 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. Brian, he's fired. He has no authority to eat food under any circumstance. And it led me to this idea that, and it was just in jest that I did it, because I was like, I'm gonna drive myself mad, like I'm gonna die. Like the kids are not gonna have a father because I'm gonna die of a heart attack. And that led me to this idea that there was this possibility of dealing with my mind in a systematic way and keeping its powers in check and elevating other parts of self. And that's what I've been building since.
And then how do you recommend people come to that same realization themselves?
I mean, everyone has I call it a power law of good behavior. When I identify evening Brian, I'd say 95% of people instantaneously identify their version of evening Brian. They all know it, right? And whether it's like the goldfish person or whether it's the alcohol person or like whatever it is, they all have their vices and they all know exactly what I'm talking about. And so there's a power law of bad behavior. People typically have one or two things which they just can't stop, which then creates a cascade event where a bunch of other bad things happen because of it. Like once you've messed up doing one thing, it's like, why not everything? And so the best thing is to identify that version of yourself and create a clearly identified profile. Like this version of me appears under these circumstances. They have these kinds of arguments. They present this kind of rationale and they do these kinds of behaviors. And after they do these things, the rest of us, like morning Brian, afternoon Brian, dad Brian, look in the mirror Brian, like the hundreds of versions of other Brians, we all hate evening Brian because he ruins our life. And so then once you understand that, and then when that character emerges, it's like, okay, you're evening Brian, and I know who you are, and I know the arguments you make, and I know the kind of behaviors you do, and you ruin everything for all of us. And then when you say no to evening Brian, evening Brian, you know, like punches holes in the wall and falls on the floor and throws a tantrum and kicks and screams and threatens everybody. He's at it totally out of control, but he has to be, you know, arrested. And so I would suggest that people try to identify this version of themselves, which then creates the cascade of everything else. And if they can get that one success under the belt, they can do other versions. So I've done this with other versions of myself now too, and I've slowly tried to chip away at it. But I have found that the less room I give my mind to move about, the better off I am.
You mentioned children in that piece, and I'm curious, how should people think about parenting, and how do you become the best parent you possibly can be?
I read a biography, A Good Man, a couple years back. His son, this gentleman's son, wrote it. And I was moved by the softness and care in which this man took to raise his children. He would write his children a note at night, a little note, and slip it under their doors. And like one note was, you know, I bought you some shaving cream and some razors because I saw you'd cut yourself shaving, you know. And like the son knew his father was observing him And even though he was in his teenage years, he was making these small observations and then doing these small acts of kindness. Of just like, I've got you, son. And I was so compelled by this care. I mean, I struggle talking about it with, you know, without getting teared up. But it's like this, it's this ever so gentle touch with your children.
What's the nicest thing you've ever, that's ever been done to you?
Well, a couple of years ago, I was out in the yard playing soccer with my son. He was, I think, 12 at the time. And I need to regain my composure. And he said, your dad, I appreciate you playing soccer with me. I bet it's not the most fun thing you could do because you're an adult and you have things you do as an adult that are probably a lot more fun than playing with a 12-year-old. And, you know, like, it just broke my heart. You know, like, his self-awareness was off the charts, and his willingness to lean into me and to acknowledge me as a human and to try to meet me in the middle of the relationship. But I'd say it's been this reciprocal nature with my children where they see my efforts and they meet me. What I'd say is the kindest thing anyone's ever done is, you know, because as a child, we give license in society for them to be selfish and self-centered and oblivious to things around them. And when they step forward and they do their part for the integrity of the relationship, you know, it's really, they're sweet moments, which I appreciate a lot.
It's beautiful. Why do you think it's so impactful for us to be seen or to be heard? Mm-hmm. What is going on there?
I mean, principally, you know, we're not very complicated creatures. We are systems of biochemical reactions, and we typically dislike pain and we like pleasure, and we go towards pleasure and we move away from pain. And that's kind of just what we do in life. And we again can come up with all these fancy stories and all these behavioral tendencies. And, you know, there of course are nuances in terms of mental conditions where those things aren't that clear. But generally speaking, you know, getting recognition is pleasurable. Being respected is pleasurable. Being shunned or ostracized by society is not pleasurable. And I think all of us are moving towards pleasure and trying to minimize pain in our lives. And I just don't know if it's, you know, if it's that much more complicated than those basic principles. Again, it can be more nuanced, and we, of course, can go at different layers of abstraction. But remembering that helps me simplify a lot of our thought. I mean, one thing the kids and I did, we would go to this running biking trail by our house, and we would buy power bars and water, and runners and bikers would come by, and we would just give them out. We had signs that said free drinks, free power bars. And it was an interesting experience because people were instantaneously suspicious of our motivations. They thought, okay, they'd ask, what does this cost? Or who are you with? Or what cause do you represent? Or, you know, they were expecting a pamphlet. And we would explain to them, we have no agenda. We're not associated with anyone. We have no purpose. We're not charging anything. We're just here to, you know, have a good time with you. And people were shocked that happened because, you know, it's expected there's a hook on every behavior. But to us, it was something that we wanted that to be a free agent in life, to not have to represent someone's interests and to just do something because, you know, it helped others. And, you know, we, of course, it was pleasurable for us too, because doing something nice for people makes you feel good. And so these are the kinds of things that get me excited about imagining our future. Is I don't think the way we are is forever how we're going to be or needs to be. And if we just, if we suspend these assumptions for a moment and we open up our minds and say, what could really happen? What could we really become? It's not impossible that we evolve ourselves into some kind of cooperation, global cooperation. It takes courage to go down that path, but it's certainly, I think, worthwhile.
I've been, when I was looking through your Twitter, I've been very impressed by how much empathy and kindness it seems like you present to people who are trying to detract from your message or trying to put you down. Where does that empathy and kindness come from?
It's extraordinarily hard to be human. Everyone's in pain. And whatever the person says, you know, I don't think it's really about me. It's really, you know, mostly about them. And, you know, it's just a form of group therapy. And if we understood each other, if we could experience what each other's experience, if we could confidently assume that other people are in just as much pain as we are, if we had that information, maybe it'd change our behaviors. But it's just tough. I mean, it's tough dealing with ourselves. It's tough dealing with each other.
When you talk about, you know, it being a painful existence and it's painful being human and it's difficult, it's hard for me to resonate. And I wish there was a scan for me to at least try it on for a few moments and so I could understand and have deeper empathy for what you experience. My personal experience has been a lot of joy and a lot of excitement and a lot of love. And I don't know if that's natural. I don't know if that's the things that I've done. What can people like me do to, one, become empathetic, but two, to help people who are having a more difficult time on this floating rock in space?
Yeah, increased kindness in the world. You know, I don't know if the tactics of our current tribalism and acrimony and, you know, I don't know if those things are really pushing things forward. And so for those who are in a fortunate position like yourself, then we all become like those around us. And yeah, so I think you sprinkling a little bit of that goodness out there, it'll probably help others. It's a great question. And I guess I really have no... Okay, so I guess I have experience in this in building company cultures where... as a company founder, I'm a primary architect of the norms and emotional cadences and intellectual proclivities within a group of people. And it's obviously a primary concern when you're building an organization that the cultural creation is like your primary product. And Yeah, then of course within self too. So I suppose I've been doing the same thing. I guess as founder of myself, I never thought about this before. I kind of have been doing the same thing within my body, where I was kind of like, hey, everybody, you're being really rowdy. It's not a cool culture around here. It's a little toxic. We need to change a few things, fire a few people, and build systems that work. Yeah, your question's a good one. I wish I had a... I wish there was an idea I had that I thought was more interesting.
That's why I ask so often about parenting on this podcast, even though I'm not a parent myself. We all are parenting ourselves at all times. We all are leading ourselves. So if you're listening to this, you're a leader, whether or not they're a group of people that you are having to talk to. It's because you're talking to yourself constantly. And you're leading yourself constantly. And we don't often stop to think about that. But you clearly did at some point. You said, oh, I am a leader of myself at least. I want to ask about ideas and creating ideas and how ideas come to be. Why is zero so important for you?
At the age of 21, I decided that I wanted to spend my life trying to do something meaningful. And the idea was make a whole bunch of money by the age of 30, then go out and do it. And so after selling Braintree Venmo, my mind had been on this problem for a long time, is how to think about existence in its most structured form, how to peel back all the layers and really try to understand what's going on. And I was trying to build mental models of how to understand the future. And I kept on coming up with what I thought were blind spots in my way of thinking. And it's very common in the world of technology to hear someone say from a first principles perspective. First principles thinking is you're basically trying to make the fewest number of assumptions given a certain time frame. But that didn't satisfy me because there are these rare events that happen which change everything. So for example, Einstein's work in understanding space-time, you know, graduated Newtonian physics into a different kind of physics that changed our understanding of the universe. And if someone was going about this from a first principles perspective, it may not have been obvious to them. But Einstein was working in this creative landscape of not necessarily working with that view. He's going with this creative, like, what if I was, you know, riding next to a at the speed of light? And so I had read this book at the same time, the biography of Zero, and it chronicled the difficulty society had in discovering the number zero and then putting zero into practice, and how zero had wrecked not only mathematics, but religions and philosophies and societies. It is this incredibly powerful thing. And I never thought about the number of zero before that. It just was a thing that was given to me. And of course, it's just part of the numbers, but zero is unique in that it enables infinity and also zero, like on both sides. And so I wanted to come up with this model, this idea of how to think about the future. And I came up with this idea of zeroth principle thinking. And it's the idea that talent hits the target no one else can. Genius hits the target no one else can see. First principles is an exercise of hitting the target that no one else can hit. Zeroth principle thinking is a genius in that identifies a target no one else can see. And that's what I was trying to look at, of if we're looking at the future, again, back to our previous conversation of what is the ideal human in 2050, we can't get there with first principles only. You have to incorporate some zeroth principle thinking. You have to say, what is the target no one can see? And that's robot in the sand. And it's how do you build these systems that are adaptable to get there? And if you look at the number of zeroth principle ideas that have landed in the world, they've been sporadic. They're hard to come up with. And if you look at the rate in which the AI is introducing zeroth principle discoveries, it's at a much faster rate. And so let's just say over the past couple thousand years, we've had a first principle discovery, you know, like one every blank amount of time, and a zeroth every whatever, but we've only had a, we've had a ratio of like, let's say 50 first principle ideas to every zeroth. But that ratio is going to change, and we're going to start having a lot more zeroth principle discoveries, which is going to change our reality to speed that is unimaginable to us. And that's why I say that in this moment in 2023, when we're mapping out the future, it's much more important we incorporate zeroth principle thinking and understanding that map, and then building systems that allow us to naturally go towards that. Again, my body. My body, I've said, you can be a first principle system and a zeroth principle system, and I'm going to pull my mind out of it. Like, let the system run with evidence and data, and let it move with the algorithm. And so as a species, same with robot in the sand. And so yes, so zeroth principle thinking to me is a, it's a tool of future literacy that should be taught in schools and should be part of our vernacular today of how we understand the world and where we're heading into.
What are example, what's the example of your body operating with zero principle and first principle? Like, where's the difference there? Could you help illustrate that for me?
Yeah, there's, we've done, so we do all these measurements, and then we say, okay, we know that optimal clinical outcomes for liver enzymes are blank. And the scientific evidence says, you know, eat broccoli and cauliflower and like this and that, and you get optimal liver enzymes, and liver enzymes of a 16-year-old are of this profile. So, you know, do these things to be of a 16-year-old healthy profile. And so those things are done, and you get it in system, and then there's other things that happen as a result of the system you put into place. Other benefits that happen in the body, other health benefits that happen in the body. And I would categorize those as, in that system, a zero, because they weren't the intended target. It was a externality event, and it's an additional thing that happens. Now that's a constrained example in body, right? Like you, of like basically you're identifying what wasn't known to exist you're discovering, because it wasn't the intended target you were designing with first principles. And so when you allow a system to run, you're discovering both negative and positive things, negative externalities and positive externalities. But it's really the system that runs. And so if you say, another tangible example of zeroth principle insight is when AlphaGo was playing Go and beat the world champion, who had won the world champion 19 times in a row, on its, I think it was like move 37. I forget the number of moves, but when it played it, that, you know, there are two moves in particular, the observers of the game, you know, said, this is like an alien playing from another dimension. It blew everyone's minds. There's been human genius has played this game for thousands of years. AlphaGo showed up and made moves that humans hadn't done previously, which broke everyone's conventions. I would call that a zeroth principle move, because it was genius that could have been discovered by humans, but it wasn't. So genius hit the talent no one else could see. Genius hit the target no one else could see. And so it go ahead.
If you had to predict how many zero principled ideas do you think there will be in the next 5 years, 10 years, and 100 years?
It's reasonable to assume that zeroth principle insights will have some kind of exponential curve when you add computational AI.
Why is it reasonable?
Because the speed at which it can move through information.
What was a zeroth principle idea or happening that happened in your own life where it broke your version of reality?
Demoting my conscious mind and elevating all the organs of me. So to me, it is a first principles approach on taking care of your body would be something like self-discipline, egg whites for breakfast, like the routines of you're trying to assume the fewest number of things on a given time frame. And if you then say, okay, actually, I'm just going to remove the decision maker altogether, and I'm going to build this system of measurement, science, and protocol, it hits a target that no one could see. It's like, basically, who out there is saying the best solution to the game here is to remove our brains from the equation? Like, let's remove ourselves from the principal agents here. And I'm saying I need to remove myself as the principal agent of taking care of me.
And then how would you say that someone should go about doing this themselves? Someone listening might be like, I can't get the science test, the results, the all this is expensive, right? Like, to create this reality, mm-hmm. not to remove yourself as the sole arbiter, but to look at the tests and to make adjustments based on the mm-hmm. tests. What should the average person do?
There's a really great win. There's a great baby step of a win here. It's identifying, again, the power law of bad behaviors. It's identifying that one version of you that creates havoc and leads to the cascading events of bad behaviors. And so it's basically separating you from self. And it's identifying that you can revoke powers of self that do not act in your best interest. So you don't need to incorporate the entirety of Blueprint. You don't need the entirety of my protocol. You can just do that basic step and then watch yourself throw a tantrum right in front of your eyes. Like, you're going to kick and scream and beg. You're going to come up with dozens of arguments of why you should still be in charge and why it's a crazy idea. Just watch yourself throw an absolute tantrum. But you have to really separate yourself from mind on this. And then once you do so, again, like, liberating me from myself has been the best thing I've done in my entire life. And I would say, as a species, we might want to contemplate this. Our future may depend upon us removing ourselves from the whole situation, not obsessed about solving the problems, but literally removing ourselves from trying to solve this problem and letting systems solve them in our place.
Brian, I normally end these podcasts with a challenge, but I think you just presented the challenge to people, and I'm really grateful. Do you have an additional challenge you'd like to direct people to live the best possible life?
Are you asking me to think of one? Or if I have one,
you just gave a great challenge for people. Remove yourself from the operations of being in your mind. But if you would like to add an additional one, an additional challenge for people listening, do any come to mind for you?
I'd say the challenge is identify the rascal in you that is responsible for 80% of your bad behavior, and eliminate their authority from doing those things that cause you misery and pain, and just observe them as they go through crisis of losing their power.
Brian, thank you so much for your time. I'm really grateful for you. Broke my brain a few times in this conversation, and because of that, I'm very grateful. Where can we send people to connect with you further?
I primarily hang out on Twitter.
Awesome. That's linked below. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Danny.